Chapter 12. What really happened on September 11th? The incident. On September 11th, 2001, four airplanes were hijacked on American soil and crashed into the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and a field in Pennsylvania. The official word. The 19 hijackers were all fanatic Muslim terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda and its ringleader, Osama bin Laden. My take? Our government engaged in a massive cover-up of what really happened, including its own ties to the hijackers. Unanswered questions remain about how the towers were brought down and whether a plane really struck the Pentagon. The Bush administration either knew about the plan and allowed it to proceed, or they had a hand in it themselves. The truth is incontrovertible. Malice may attack it, ignorance may deride it, but in the end, there it is. Winston Churchill. I was in my third year as Minnesota's governor on September 11, 2001. After the devastation of the Pentagon being hit and the Twin Towers falling, I put the National Guard on alert and secured some of our public buildings. The following Sunday morning, we were the first state to hold a memorial for the nearly 3,000 victims. More than 40,000 people showed up on the front lawn of the state capitol while a steady rain fell. I'll never forget Native American shamans beating drums alongside honor guards who represented the police and firefighters and military. It still chokes me up to think about it. Looking out on hundreds of flags fluttering in the breeze, I remember saying at the end of 2 hours, "We will promote good against evil, and finally we will together restore our sense of freedom by conquering this enemy." I never wanted to believe anything different than what our government told us about that tragic day. But here is what John Farmer, a senior counsel for the 9/11 Commission, who drafted the original report, has to say in a new book. At some level of the government, at some point in time, there was an agreement not to tell the truth about what happened. What more do we need? Are we willing to live with another lie to go with the Warren Report, the Iran-Contra cover-up, and many other official stories? I certainly never expected to think that elements of the Bush administration were complicit with the enemy. Today, though, I am convinced that some people inside our government knew the attack was going to happen and allowed it to come to pass because it furthered their political agenda. I don't necessarily believe that they orchestrated it themselves, although the door is definitely open to that. I say this after expending many hours researching things about the official story that don't add up, and interviewing a number of witnesses with first-hand knowledge that contradicts what we were told. As a patriotic American, I say this with a heavy heart, and with an outrage that really knows no words. But it's something we, as a nation, must come to terms with. Otherwise, it could happen again. From day one, there was something that puzzled me. You had four airplanes being hijacked on the same morning. Maybe the first one snuck by the radar, but the next three? I'd been inside air traffic control, where you've got a dozen people watching every plane in their sector. They know what direction all the aircraft are supposed to be going, and here were four planes going directly opposite of their normal flight path. But we're supposed to believe that no alarm bells went off anywhere, so no fighter jets got scrambled to intercept the planes. Was everybody asleep at the switch? How could the FAA and our air defenses experience such a miserable failure? I want to tell you a story about a guy named Charles Lewis, who my writing colleague Dick Russell interviewed recently in Southern California. Until 2 months before September 11th, Lewis had worked at LAX as the quality control manager for Kiewit Pacific Construction on its Taxiway C project. A large part of his duties involved security in the airport operations area, or AOA. There he got to know employees of various agencies, the L.A. World Airport Police, the LAPD, and California Highway Patrol, the FBI, U.S. Customs, and others. When the 9/11 attacks occurred, Lewis was a deputy inspector for the city of L.A. during a seismic retrofit of the L.A. Hilton Towers Hotel, only a few minutes from the airport by car. After making sure the hotel construction crew went home, Lewis rushed over to LAX's Guard Post 2 because he was one of very few people who knew how to fix certain parts of the new security systems in case any problems developed. Lewis estimates he arrived at about 6:35 a.m. Pacific time, 9:35 a.m. Eastern, not long after the second plane struck the World Trade Center. As on other days, there was chatter on LAX security walkie-talkies, and he could easily hear what they were saying, sometimes both sides of the conversation. Lewis remembers, "The first thing I noticed was that the guards, and that day they were the L.A. World Airport Police and the FBI, were very upset and agitated, because apparently no one from FAA had notified NORAD, North American Aerospace Defense Command. They were making calls and demanding to know why not. Eventually, word came back that NORAD had indeed been notified, but they had been ordered to stand down. Then LAX security wanted to know who could have made that order. And word came back that it was from the highest level of the White House. Later on, watching television, I knew the order didn't come from Bush because he was reading My Pet Goat to the school kids in Florida. So the only other person it could be was Dick Cheney. It turns out there were some war games taking place that morning. September 11th was the second day of Vigilant Guardian, an exercise of the Joint Chiefs and NORAD that simulated planes being hijacked in the northeastern United States. Another drill called Northern Vigilance had shifted some fighter jets to Canada and Alaska to monitor Russian MiGs flying training missions. This one put phantoms on military radar screens that would look real to the participants in the exercise. We fought many phantoms that day, Richard Myers of the Joint Chiefs later testified to Congress. But could the attack have been scheduled intentionally to coincide with those war games? If so, this raises a couple of questions. Either there was a major intelligence leak, whereby the terrorists realized the war games would be a good cover for their operation, or else some people in the administration knew of the attack ahead of time and let it proceed simultaneously, knowing the confusion this would cause. Between September 2000 and June 2001, on 67 different occasions, fighter jets were sent to intercept aircraft that had lost radio contact or their transponder signal, or were flying off course, usually within 10 minutes of any sign of a problem. Contrary to what some people think, presidential approval wasn't needed to intercept or even shoot down an aircraft. Then on June 1, 2001, the existing hijacking response procedures were changed to require approval by the Secretary of Defense before responding to a situation with lethal force. And when the call came into the Pentagon on 9/11, nobody answered the phone. The stand-down order that Charles Lewis heard about was confirmed by none other than Norman Mineta, Transportation Secretary at the time. According to the 9/11 Commission, Cheney didn't arrive underground at the PEOC, Presidential Emergency Operations Center, until almost 10 a.m. Mineta, however, said the vice president was already down there when he arrived at about 9:20 a.m. Richard Clark and Cheney's photographer indicated the same thing. That was before the Pentagon had been hit, and Mineta recalled a young man coming into the PEOC three times to tell Cheney how far out the plane was from Washington. After the third report, according to Mineta, the young fellow asked, "Do the orders still stand?" And Cheney responded, "Of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?" The 9/11 Commission chose to ignore Mineta's testimony and went so far as to remove it from the video archive. Instead, they had Cheney ordering, almost 45 minutes later than Mineta said, the inbound aircraft be shot down. Except by then, all four planes had already gone down. That was cover-up number one by the 9/11 Commission. Now let's look at whether it was actually those two planes that were responsible for the falling towers. I was amazed watching the 2007 version of the documentary Loose Change, which I urge everyone to see, at the many firefighters and other eyewitnesses who talked about a whole series of explosions before and during the collapse of the buildings. All of this was reported on the news at the time. Before the South Tower collapsed, video footage clearly shows sizable amounts of white smoke starting to pour out of the base. There was described a giant rolling ball of flame that came up from street level, an elevator that exploded on the 65th floor as someone stood beside it, a woman on the 49th floor seeing people with burns and broken arms in the stairwells. For every window in the lobby to be exploding, it wasn't from the jet fuel, no way, according to one of the witnesses, and a whole lot more that did not jive with any plane striking the building. Barry Jennings, the city's emergency coordinator, was at the scene before and after the building collapses. Jennings puts it out there plainly. I know what I heard. I heard explosions. For my TV show, I interviewed a witness named William Rodriguez, a janitor who happened to have a master key and rescued many people and got honored at the White House as a national hero. He says that shortly before American Airlines Flight 11 struck the North Tower at 8:46 a.m., an explosion simultaneously rocked the building so hard, it pushed us up. Rodriguez later testified behind closed doors to the 9/11 Commission, but his name was never mentioned in the report. Rodriguez also gave the Commission and the FBI a list of 14 people who had been with him, but not a single one was ever contacted. He produced his boss for us, who looked me right in the eye and, in essence, told me the same story. What's happened to Rodriguez today? He's on the no-fly list. A guy who went back in to save people with no regard for his own life. When he goes somewhere, he's pulled out of the line, interrogated, harassed. All because, I guess, he didn't give the proper testimony they wanted. Some people have argued that the Twin Towers went down within a half hour of one another because of the way they were constructed. Well, those 425,000 cubic yards of concrete and 200,000 tons of steel were designed to hold up against a Boeing 707, the largest plane built at the time the towers were completed in 1973. Analysis had shown that a 707 traveling at 600 miles an hour, and those had four engines, would not cause major damage. The twin-engine Boeing 757s that hit on 9/11 were going 440 and 550 miles an hour. Still, we are told that a molten, highly intense fuel mixture from the planes brought down these two steel-framed skyscrapers. Keep in mind that no other such skyscraper in history had ever been known to collapse completely due to fire damage. So could it actually have been the result of a controlled demolition from inside the buildings? I don't claim expertise about this, but I did work 4 years as part of the Navy's underwater demolition teams, where we were trained to blow things to hell in high water. And my staff talked at some length with a prominent physicist, Stephen E. Jones, who says that a gravity-driven collapse without demolition charges defies the laws of physics. These buildings fell at nearly the rate of freefall, straight down into their own footprint, in approximately 10 seconds. An object dropped from the roof of the 110-story-tall towers would reach the ground in about 9.2 seconds. Then there's the fact that steel beams that weighed as much as 200,000 pounds got tossed laterally as far as 500 feet. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, NISI, started its investigation on August 21, 2002. When their 10,000-page long report came out 3 years later, the spokesman said there was no evidence to suggest a controlled demolition. But Stephen E. Jones also says that molten metal found underground weeks later is proof that jet fuel couldn't have been all that was responsible. I visited the site about 3 weeks after 9/11 with Governor Pataki and my wife, Terry. It didn't mean anything to me at the time, but they had to suspend digging that day because they were running into heat pockets of huge temperatures. These fires kept burning for more than 3 months, the longest-burning structure blaze ever. And this was all due to jet fuel? We're talking molten metal, more than 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Probably the most conclusive evidence about a controlled demolition is a research paper, 2 years, 9 authors, published in the peer-reviewed Open Chemical Physics Journal in April 2009. In studying dust samples from the site, these scientists found chips of nanothermite, which is a high-tech, incendiary explosive. Here's what the paper's lead author, Dr. Niels Harrit of the University of Copenhagen's Chemistry Department, had to say about the explosive that he's convinced brought down the Twin Towers and the nearby Building 7. Thermite itself dates back to 1893. It is a mixture of aluminum and rust powder, which react to create intense heat. The reaction produces iron, heated to 2,500 degrees centigrade. This can be used to do welding. It can also be used to melt other iron. So in nanothermite, this powder from 1893 is reduced to tiny particles perfectly mixed. When these react, the intense heat develops much more quickly. Nanothermite can be mixed with additives to give off intense heat or serve as a very effective explosive. It contains more energy than dynamite and can be used as rocket fuel. Richard Gage is one of hundreds of credentialed architects and structural engineers who have put their careers on the line to point out the detailed anomalies and many implications of controlled demolition in the building collapses. As he puts it bluntly, once you get to the science, it's indisputable. So what happened to the steel debris from the World Trade Center that might have backed this up? Well, for the most part, it was shipped overseas. The removal by 4 companies contracted by the city was carefully controlled and monitored. The building assessment performance team wasn't allowed to take samples. One firefighter I spoke with who got dug out of the rubble on 9/11 said, "The one thing that always troubled me is, why were they in such a hurry to remove all the evidence? Why did they take away everything from the site as fast and expediently as possible?" I tried to talk to someone from the 9/11 Commission, but got turned down multiple times. They simply said, "We stand by our report." I also tried to speak with Mayor Giuliani, but he refused also. We recently learned through the DA of Manhattan's testimony in a court case that the city of New York did nothing to investigate 9/11. That tells me Giuliani was nothing but a straw man. Why is he paraded around as this big hero when he really had nothing to do with it other than be a figurehead? Again, I ask, what happened to state and local laws? Homicides are supposed to be investigated by the jurisdiction where they happen. Who has the power to suspend all those laws and make them irrelevant, turning it into an investigation completely controlled by the feds? Seems that they feel they're above us. We work now for the government, not the other way around. That's not the way this country was founded. I think we have a right to know who ran that investigation so we can properly critique it. I wanted to ask Mayor Giuliani specifically about the collapse of Building 7, late on the afternoon of the attacks. If all these buildings are falling as a result of fires, shouldn't we be changing the way we build them? In this case, you had Building 7 that wasn't struck by anything. I went to the BBC and got the footage where a reporter is standing in front of it, incongruously saying that it's already come down almost a half hour before it did. I tried to talk to the reporter, but the BBC turned me down, explaining that that day was extremely hectic and they're not part of any conspiracy. A few hours before the attack, for some reason, Building 7's alarm system went on test status. The power was shut off, and all tenants evacuated after the second plane hit. People were reporting major fires on the east, north, and west faces that covered about six of the floors. One witness, Michael Hess, reported a major explosion on the sixth floor and being trapped for 90 minutes, two floors above that, until he was rescued by the fire department. Well, just like the Twin Towers, the 47-story Building 7 fell symmetrically into its own footprint in 6.5 seconds, sending the same type of pyroplastic cloud down the surrounding streets that demolition is known to cause. Keep in mind that other nearby buildings with much worse damage never collapsed, not Building 3, which was split in half by the South Tower's debris, not Building 4, otherwise almost completely destroyed, not Buildings 5 or 6, which suffered severe fires and structure damage. And they were much smaller than Building 7, where 81 columns all had to collapse at the same time due to fires on just a few floors. So why did Building 7 come down as it did? What's being covered up? I've got questions about the attack on the Pentagon also. Getting back to Charles Lewis and what he heard that morning on the walkie-talkies out at LAX, the security guards referred to a missile having hit the Pentagon. I was kind of puzzled, Lewis says, because by the time the airport had been evacuated and I got home, the missile that had hit the Pentagon had mysteriously changed to being another plane. I couldn't figure that out, because I didn't take the FBI or the L.A. World Airport Police to be putting on a pageant for me. Of course, officially, it was American Airlines Flight 77 that crashed into the ground floor at 9:37 a.m. Only a section of the Pentagon that had been reinforced to withstand a terrorist attack was hit. Anywhere else, the damage and the casualties would have been much worse. Left behind by a plane some 100 feet wide was a hole 16 feet deep, but no evidence to accompany it, which is something that former Air Force fighter pilot Russ Wittenberg says he'd never seen happen. Captain Wittenberg also says that jet engines do not leave a trail of white smoke, as was seen at the Pentagon. We don't know what it was, but you can tell what it wasn't, according to Wittenberg. And he believes it wasn't a 757 aircraft. Another doubter is Major General Albert Stubblebine, retired commanding general of the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command, who was responsible for the Army's strategic intelligence sources worldwide. I have had a lot of experience looking at photographs, Stubblebine says. I don't know exactly what hit it, the Pentagon, but I do know from photographs I have analyzed, it was not an airplane. For one thing, if you look at the hole that was made in the Pentagon, the nose penetrated far enough so that there should have been wing marks on the side of the building. One person counteracted my theory and said, "Oh, you've got it all wrong. The airplane came across, one wing hit the ground and broke off." Which is possible, but if I understand airplanes correctly, most of them have two wings, so there should have been a mark for the second one. Stubblebine also believes the Twin Towers were brought down by a controlled demolition. How could a Boeing 757, with its engines extending beneath its wings, have struck the Pentagon so low without damaging the lawn and destroying the large cable spools on the ground in front of the damaged area? Asks 9/11 expert David Ray Griffin, a California professor and the author of 8 books exploring the contradictions of the official 9/11 story. Griffin also cites the observation of Karen Kwiatkowski, then an Air Force lieutenant colonel employed at the Pentagon, who saw no airplane metal or cargo debris. Here's what troubled me. The law was immediately and completely broken there. They had military personnel out on the lawn cleaning everything up before an investigator ever arrived. Those hasty cleanups now seem to be standard operating procedure when it comes to assassinations and events like 9/11, don't they? Whenever there's a plane crash, things are strewn about. So where are the seats, the luggage? The wings, vertical stabilizers, and engines were never fully recovered. A number of parts to a 757 are pretty much indestructible, but not a single piece has ever been positively identified as originating with Flight 77. The Department of Justice has admitted to having 85 videos, but they've been refused a Freedom of Information Act request to release them. Another expert we communicated with is Colonel George Nelson, who during 30 years of commissioned service in the Air Force served as an Aircraft Accident Investigation Board member. Colonel Nelson says, "With all the evidence readily available at the Pentagon crash site, any unbiased, rational investigator could only conclude that a Boeing 757 did not fly into the Pentagon as alleged. In all my years of direct and indirect participation, I never witnessed nor even heard of an aircraft loss where the wreckage was accessible that prevented investigators from finding enough hard evidence to positively identify the make, model, and specific registration number of the aircraft, and in most cases the precise cause of the accident." Then there's the background on the pilot. His name was Charles Chick Burlingame, and he was not only well-schooled in martial arts, but a retired Top Gun pilot, the best of the best. All his friends said, there's no way he'd give up his plane. It wasn't in the man's makeup. Unless the hijackers got to him and killed him. But with box cutters? Supposedly, a hijacker named Hanjour got control of the plane. Except later, his flight instructor described Hanjour as barely being able to handle a single-engine Cessna a month earlier. And Flight 77 is said to have made a complicated 330-degree turn, dropping 7,000 feet, executing a maneuver that experienced pilots say is nearly impossible. The section of the Pentagon that was struck happened to be the headquarters for naval operations and intelligence, as well as housing quite a few accountants and budget analysts. Important Pentagon financial information disappeared in the aftermath of the attack, so it's quite a coincidence that just the day before, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld had announced publicly, according to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions. That's right, not million, not even billion. That was trillion. Flight 77 disappeared from the FAA radar screen at 8:56 a.m. when it made an unauthorized turn to the south, somewhere near the Kentucky-Ohio border. The only evidence that the plane was still flying and headed toward Washington were two phone calls that Ted Olson said he received from his wife Barbara on board, not long before the Pentagon strike. Ted Olson was a longtime Republican operative who spearheaded the legal effort for Bush in Florida after the disputed 2000 election, and then went to work in the Justice Department as Solicitor General. His wife was the only person who is reported to have mentioned box cutters. According to Olson, she said that all passengers and flight personnel, including the pilots, were herded to the back of the plane by armed hijackers. Yep, 60-some people, including a weightlifter pilot, being held off by a few short, slender guys holding knives and box cutters. At first, Olson said the calls were made from Barbara's cell phone, except high-altitude cell phone calls were pretty much impossible in 2001. Olson then changed his story to claim she'd used an onboard phone to make a collect call, except American Airlines didn't have such phones on the Boeing 757s. Here's what the FBI reported in 2006 at the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker. Barbara Olson made only one call, an unconnected call, that lasted 0 seconds. So what's going on? Captain Wittenberg has said that if Flight 77 was actually off the radar screen for 36 minutes, then it was no longer airborne. Did it land in some remote field while something else, maybe the missile Charles Lewis heard about at LAX, hit the Pentagon's financial records area? This probably sounds far-fetched, if not crazy, until you consider that elements of our military had an eerily similar plan ready to roll back in the early 1960s. It was called Operation Northwoods, first described in a book published in 2001, Body of Secrets by James Bamford. Operation Northwoods was approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff for action against Castro's Cuba. What may be the most corrupt plan ever created by the U.S. government, as Bamford put it. The Kennedy brothers seemed to be going soft on Castro, so the generals came up with a number of terrorist schemes to launch a war. Bamford tells us, among the most elaborate schemes was to create an incident which will demonstrate convincingly that a Cuban aircraft has attacked and shot down a chartered civil airliner. An aircraft at Eglin Air Force Base would be painted and numbered as an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft. At a designated time, the duplicate would be substituted for the actual civil aircraft and would be loaded with the selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft would be converted to a drone, a remotely controlled unmanned aircraft. Takeoff times of the drone aircraft and the actual aircraft will be scheduled to allow a rendezvous south of Florida. From the rendezvous point, the passenger-carrying aircraft will descend to minimum altitude and go directly into an auxiliary field at Eglin Air Force Base, where arrangements will have been made to evacuate the passengers and return the aircraft to its original status. The drone aircraft, meanwhile, will continue to fly the filed flight plan. When over Cuba, the drone will be transmitting on the internal distress frequency a Mayday message stating he is under attack by Cuban MiG aircraft. The transmission will be interrupted by destruction of the aircraft, which will be triggered by radio signal. If you're interested, you can read the whole plan on the website of the National Security Archive.